Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Floyd Norman. Welcome.
Hello there. I'm Floyd Norman. Who am I? I am an animator, animation storyteller, story artist. I've done every job imaginable in animation. Loved every minute of it. And I'm still doing it even today at the ripe old age of 87. So happy to be here.
Happy to have you. So you were born and raised in Santa Barbara, California. How was it growing up?
Fantastic. I'm one of the few people who can actually say my childhood was almost perfect. It was idyllic. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the right place at the right time. And lucky me that I was born back in 1935 in Santa Barbara, California, a general hospital. And man, oh man, all I can say is what a lucky kid I was to grow up in what was just an ideal community, a creative community, because we had a lot of creative people in Santa Barbara back in those days. I guess we still do. Mm-hmm. Oprah amongst them. Mm-hmm. But we had actors and screenwriters and choreographers and novelists. And, you know, we had creative people, musicians, composers. And so all of us kids growing up in Santa Barbara were encouraged to go into the arts. I would think most practical parents would say, kid, you know, go to college and learn how to, you know, get a real job. Mm-hmm. But we were lucky that we had crazy people to mentor us, you know, other creatives like ourselves. Mm-hmm. Kid, if you want to be an actor, go to Hollywood and be an actor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your mom took you to go see Dumbo. What was fascinating to you about that movie?
I love going to movies. Keep in mind, back in those days, back in the ancient days, we did not have television yet. Mm-hmm. So our, you know, the pinnacle of entertainment was going to the movie theater. And good heavens, I think I must have gone to the movies every week. You know, I mean, when I got older, I was able to go on my own. But mm-hmm. when I was a little kid, my mommy used to take me to the movies. And we would see Walt Disney films like Bambi and Dumbo. And I found, well, number one, I found movies magical anyway. Mm-hmm. I found animation especially magical. And I truly love that Disney stuff.
So you drew in your grandparents' books and magazines and on the walls?
Sure did.
Did you get in trouble for that?
Oh, yeah. I got a few spankings, I would imagine, for, you know, drawing with my crayons on the baseboard and on the walls of our home, my parents' home and my grandparents' home. Mm-hmm. But it's when you're an artist, you can't help but draw. I mean, you have to draw. And so that means you will draw on anything. So that meant I drew in magazines. I drew in books. My little scribbles were literally all over my parents' house and my grandparents' house. But that's because I was an artist. I guess I was born to be an artist. And I just could not stop drawing. And so I drew on every surface.
Can you talk about the importance of your grandmother you were about to go into earlier? Can you talk about her?
My grandmother was an incredible person. Not that my mother wasn't, because my mother was extremely supportive. Although my mother did not always understand my dreams and my goals and my ambitions. Well, she supported me. She was never negative. But when it comes to real support, my grandmother was exceptional. My grandmother, like my parents and our whole family, they were all from the South. And I really don't know where my grandmother received her education. But boy, she was a very savvy woman. Her name was Emma Fitzgerald Davis. She married my grandfather. My grandfather lost his wife when she was quite young. And so my grandfather married again, and he married this Southern woman, rather fair skin Southern woman. She was Black, but she was very fair. Mm-hmm. And that was Emma Fitzgerald Davis. And she was an incredibly ambitious young woman. And I don't know where she got her knowledge. I don't even know her educational background. But boy, she was savvy when it came to business. And she was totally supportive of me when she found out that I loved Walt Disney and animated cartoons. And I told my grandmother that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. And she said, well, let's do it. And so she was incredibly supportive. She seemed to understand something that nobody else, no other adult understood. She understood the animation process. How she knew that, I do not know. But she helped me build an animation camera stand. She helped me acquire my first 16mm motion picture camera. She helped me make animated films, and she kind of like made that pathway from Santa Barbara to Burbank to the Walt Disney Studio. Mm-hmm. She knew that one day I was going to work for Walt Disney, and she was going to make every effort to see that her grandson realized his dream. So I owe a great deal to my grandmother, because she was my biggest supporter and just a real inspiration.
She kind of sounds similar to my dad, because when I worked at this company called Turbo Squid in New Orleans, I worked there for maybe 3 to 4 years. And it, to people who aren't in the animation industry, it's hard to explain, because you have to use all these industry terms.
But nobody understands. Yeah.
So, but then I remember having a phone conversation with him one day, and then he just explained it simply. And I'm just like, how do you do that? Here every day, and I can't explain it, but you're just like, oh, it's this. And then I couldn't remember what he said.
Yeah. What we do for a living is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And so, and to the layperson, it can be difficult to explain, you know, these moving pictures or moving drawings. Now, of course, today it's moving digital images, but, you know, again, images that are moving, and the technology has changed over the years, but then again, the technology was always changing anyway. So, but we're still doing the same thing, essentially, that is telling stories, making movies.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like with you saying, talking about your grandmother's education, personally, I feel like, you know, some of our grandparents, even if they didn't have that much education, they're still smarter than a lot of people who went to college today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you bet. I doubt if my grandmother and grandfather ever went to business school. Mm-hmm. But boy, they knew how to manage money. Mm-hmm. I wish they had spent more time teaching me that, because that's the one thing when I became a grown-up, I knew nothing about managing money, and I could have used their expertise when it came to, you know, knowing how to invest and, you know, because my grandparents, I mean, even with their limited resources, purchased real estate. Mm-hmm. In Santa Barbara, California, starting back in the 1930s or right. earlier. And they were smart enough to know this is what we should be doing. Now, they had restrictions. My grandparents were they wanted to buy beachfront property, mm-hmm. which probably if they had purchased beachfront property, they would have ended up millionaires. But of course, the way things were back then, they did not allow people of color mm-hmm. to invest, you know, yeah. in prime property. They were able to buy property in Santa Barbara, but not the, you know, beachfront property, which would have eventually made them wealthy. Yeah. Would have made me wealthy as well. But yeah. Sadly, they were prevented from doing so.
So in your childhood, you studied the violin, clarinet, flute, and played in the high school band and orchestra. Do you still play any instruments?
No, I don't. I wish I did. You know, sadly, that aspect of my life kind of went away when I no longer had a band to play in. I mean, and a lot of my musical adventures were just out of love of music and for fun. I never had any intention of becoming a professional musician, mm-hmm. although I love music and I love hanging around those who are, you know, talented musically. It seems every member of my family played something. Mm-hmm. My brothers were especially talented. My older brother, James, was a pianist, very talented guy. My younger brother, Wendell, played the woodwinds. Oh, he played piano too, but he played the winds, the clarinet, mm-hmm. flute, saxophone. He played the bassoon in the Santa Barbara Symphony Orchestra. So the bassoon, which is part of symphonic music, is a very difficult instrument. And I remember the conductor of our Santa Barbara Symphony, a man named Ernest Gohl, was a film composer. He actually wrote motion picture scores in Hollywood, but he lived in Santa Barbara, which is, you know, nearby, not that far from Hollywood. Yeah. So again, like I said, these were the people we had around us. They were people who were in the film community, in the television community, and they were our neighbors and our friends and our teachers in my hometown of Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard you talk about your getting a sneak peek into the luxury when your childhood from your mom and grandma cleaning houses.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandmother was often a cook for some of the wealthy families in nearby Montecito or Hope Ranch. These were exclusive communities, mainly for the well-to-do. Mm-hmm. People of color, Black, Latino people were the cooks, the maids, the housekeepers, the gardeners. You know, that was the way things were in those days. So what that did was, because my parents and grandparents often worked for wealthy people, it gave me the opportunity to go into some of those homes. So I became quite accustomed to wandering through the mansions of Montecito and Hope Ranch, and to essentially get a firsthand look at how the other half lives. So yeah. It was very insightful for me as a young kid to get that look at the at Santa Barbara's elite.
Did it ever give you anything to strive for, or did you never want to be that rich, or like?
Well, no, it made me realize that, boy, oh boy, if it comes to a choice of being rich and being poor, I'd sure prefer being rich. Oh yeah, yeah, it did. But what it also helped was that it didn't give me a warped view of money. And that is, it's great to live in a big house. It's great to have money in the bank. But that didn't necessarily buy you happiness.
Right.
And that was a very important lesson I learned even as a kid, that even if you had lots and lots of money, it didn't necessarily mean you would have a happy life. Because many, many wealthy people that I knew in Santa Barbara were not happy at all. And they were rich and they weren't happy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm mentioning on Facebook maybe yesterday that the only way I would live in a mansion is if I can fill it up with other people, because I'm a very scary person. So I like my spaces to be small, because if something makes a noise, I want to know what. So if I live in a mansion by myself, I'm going to be scared all the time, because I'm like, what?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, you're right about that. Some of those homes were awfully big. I was never intimidated by the size of some of these homes. Mm-hmm. I was often amazed at how different their lives were when compared to ours. For instance, you were lucky if you were, you know, middle class family, if you had a children's room. So that was the way we thought about it, you know, the kids' room.
Yeah. But
wealthy, they had the children's wing. You know, not the kids' room, the kids' wing. Children had their own wing of the house, and I thought, man, that's living high. You know, that's the good life.
Yeah. So
I was aware of all those things by being exposed to, you know, these plush homes and Hope Ranch and Montecito, and in Santa Barbara proper, because we had our fair share of elegant homes.
Mm-hmm.
In Santa Barbara as well, up in the Alameda Padre Sierra, which was the hillside that overlooked the city, a gorgeous view of the city of Santa Barbara and the Pacific Ocean. So it was just a gorgeous place to grow up. I mean, we had everything, you know, the ocean, the mountains. It was just a wonderful place for a kid to grow up.
Did you have any favorite traditions or things that you did growing up with your family?
Traditions. I don't think any different from the average family, you know. Family outings, picnics. I remember one of the highlights of when I was a kid, our church always had a church picnic. And that was always kind of like a big deal because that was an annual picnic and we had it once a year. And, you know, you'd go out and you'd grill and all this food and then the kids would run and play and we would go down to the stream or we would climb the mountains. It was just a fun day and it was a real wholesome family type, church picnic.
Yeah.
And it was stuff like that. I mean, it really, our lives were not unusual in any way. They were quite normal. Mm-hmm. But I just look back on my childhood as just being just a lot of joy, a lot of fun, a lot of no trauma, no stress.
Mm-hmm.
We were blessed with sufficient in terms of enough to eat and a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't poor by any means. We certainly weren't wealthy,
mm-hmm.
but neither were we poor.
Mm-hmm.
And we never, I don't recall ever going without. Mm-hmm. I don't recall ever being hungry. I don't recall any negatives that, and I hear this from a lot of people whose lives were not easy.
Right.
And they had a fair amount of hardships in their life. I'm happy to say I had none.
Mm-hmm.
None. I had no hardships. Again, I think, you know, again, and of course, my experience is probably unique mm-hmm. because of where I grew up, you know, in the affluent Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a very good life, and I look back on it as, and I realize I was luckier than most. And a lot of that was just where I happened to be born.
Yeah.
A lot of the choices are made for us. You know, we don't have to say so what town we're going to be born in or what part of the country or what part of the world.
Yeah.
It just happened. And I think I just, I won the golden ticket because mm-hmm. I was born in Santa Barbara. And that meant I was, I had the opportunity to a lot of good things that maybe a lot of other kids never had access to.
Mm-hmm. So this is the part where I list out projects that you worked on. Obviously not going to list out all of them because we only.
No, because I can't remember them anyway.
there
were so many.
For anything you do remember, feel free to correct me on because sometimes IMDb is wrong. So.
That's so yeah. It's usually wrong anyway. I've got all kinds of credits on IMDb. That stuff that I never worked on, but you know what are you gonna do?
So, let's see the percentage of correctness that I highlight. Sleeping Beauty.
Oh yeah, worked on that 2.5 years at the Walt Disney Studio.
101 Dalmatians.
Yep, worked on that.
Sword
and a Stone.
Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins. Loads of fun on Mary Poppins.
Two properties.
that was a film that, you know, that whole movie was made right here in Burbank. We didn't shoot anything in the UK.
Mm.
So jolly old London was right in Burbank.
The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book. The one film that I had the pleasure of working with Walt Disney,
mm-hmm.
the old maestro himself. I actually worked with Walt Disney on The Jungle Book. And that was unusual because mm-hmm. that was a movie I did not want to work on. That isn't that how it goes? Sometimes the most important things in your life, you tried to run away from. Walt Disney decided he wanted me to be on that movie.
Because you wanted to be an animator.
What's that?
You wanted to be an animator.
I wanted to be an animator. Exactly. That's why I came to Disney in the first place, because I wanted to be an animator. And Walt Disney basically said, you're not an animator. You're a story person. Mm-hmm. You're a story guy. You need to be upstairs in the story department. And I didn't know anything about telling stories. Like, what is he nuts? You know?
I feel like you still claim you don't.
I've learned a few things along the way. I've learned now I've learned how to fake it. So,
right.
Yeah. So yeah, now I write scripts. I do storyboards. I write scripts. It's all storytelling, you know, words or pictures.
Yeah.
It's all about telling a story. So, you know, but back in those days when the old man pegged me for The Jungle Book and he said, I want this kid to move upstairs and work on the story of The Jungle Book. I thought, you know, Walt had gone a little soft in the head. like, you know, he wants me to work on the story. But, you know, when the boss makes a, you know, when the boss gives an order, you simply say, yes, sir.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up working on the Jungle Book back in 1966. And it was a job that literally changed my life, because from that point on, I never really thought seriously about being an animator again. Mm-hmm. I did animate on occasion, but I was never that focused on animation. And my new focus was being an animation storyteller.
Yeah.
Because writing is probably, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's a greater challenge than animation. It's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was a job that I really never considered myself a writer. And I ended up writing many, many scripts and stories over the years, mm-hmm. something I never thought I would be doing.
Back to the list. Hey, 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 it's Fat Albert.
Yeah, that was weird. And it's so bizarre that just this morning I was reading an article about Bill Cosby and Fat Albert.
Mm-hmm.
This thing haunts me throughout my life. You see what happened back in 1967, 68, my friend and partner, Leo Sullivan, we kind of heard that Bill Cosby wanted to do something with a routine, the comedy routine he had about growing up in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys he knew, his buddies, his friends, and a big guy named Fat Albert.
Mm-hmm.
So we heard about this and we thought, okay, let's see if we can take one of Bill Cosby's albums and develop this as an animated cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we did. Well, it's a real long, convoluted story. But there was a studio set up in West Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and work began on the Fat Albert special. It was going to be a half-hour special for NBC. And it was supposed to be two half-hour specials based on Fat Albert.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as things often happen in Hollywood, there was a falling out between Bill's partners, and they parted company. And the Fat Albert project just sort of like was thrown to the winds and never completed. Eventually, many months later, the half-hour special was finished, and it did end up on NBC television sometime around 1966 or 67, and it did air one time on NBC. And then it just vanished once again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe 5 or 6 years later, it showed up again at a studio out in the valley called Filmation. And they began to develop Fat Albert as a animated TV series for Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting. I love the property. I wasn't exactly happy with the way it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the Fat Albert show was a very successful Saturday morning TV show, I felt it left a lot to be desired. I felt there was a lot of things, negative stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a product of its time,
mm-hmm.
but I never really liked the show, and I was not a big fan of Fat. I still love the character. I think the character's great. I love Fat Albert. Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, Albert.
Yeah. But I never really liked what Filmation did with the show, and again, a lot of that is because the show was made by a bunch of white guys. To be quite honest, that Fat Albert show was not made by a lot of black people.
Yeah. Yeah,
Bill Cosby still did the voice, and there were a number of African American voice actors who provided voices for the characters. But in terms of the scripts and the storyboards and the animation and all of that, the production design, it was all done by white guys, you know.
Yeah.
And nothing against white guys, because you know, a lot of my friends are white guys. But there wasn't a lot of black input.
Yeah.
On Fat Albert, and I was just never really a big fan of the show. It was not the show I wanted to do. The show that you know, that when we first began development of Fat Albert, that's not the way I saw Cosby's property, but
Yeah.
Apparently, Bill Cosby worked with Filmation, worked with Lou Scheimer, mm-hmm. and apparently was somewhat happy with the way things turned out. Mm-hmm. But I never really cared for the show all that much. And I would have liked to have done something that would have been pretty much different. So there you go. There you go with the Fat Albert story.
That's what I like about properties like Into the Spider-Verse, because you can tell we were involved.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you can tell Peter Ramsey was there.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
One of the black animators that animated like the opening sequence, and like I love that the part where he's walking down the street and like code switching and like, you know, Spanish to this person, dapping this person up and all this stuff. So it's like it's like cool to be like, oh man, you know, somebody who looked like us determined that. So
yeah no, I was a huge fan of the I had a chance to see the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse at a before the film had even been released, and one of the producers was at the screening, and after it was over, and he came up to me and he said, "Did you like the movie? Do you think it's any good?" And I said, "Any good?" I said, "Dude, you're going to win the Academy Award," you know. And he said, "What?" I said, "No, I mean this seriously. You're going to win the Oscar for Best Animated Feature," and I said, "Don't forget that. I seriously mean you are going to win the Oscar for Best Animated Feature Film." And of course they did.
Yeah.
They did win. And along with any number of other awards as well. So yeah, I knew that film, you know, it got it. It hit it. You know, it was everything it should have been, you know. But I love it when stuff like that happens, you know.
And for me, personally, as a 3D modeler and 3D artist, I like the movie because I feel like sometimes people don't like 3D because the studios have been doing it wrong.
I mean, I get a little burned out on CGI stuff myself, mainly because it has sort of a sameness to it. You know,
was unique.
It's a nature of the medium. It is what it is, and it's incredibly efficient and effective. Although I must say that when it comes right down to it, I still prefer hand-drawn animation, because to me, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with CGI, but I just love the fact of pencil and paper and putting magic on a screen using nothing but a pencil and a piece of paper. To me, that's what animation is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't knock the technology. Good heavens, I purposely chose to go up and work at Pixar for a number of years because I love what they were doing. So people say, "Oh, Ed Floyd, he's negative on CG." No, I'm not negative about CGI. And a lot of my tech heads friends who think I'm putting them down, no, I do not put them down at all. I love the technology. I'm a technology nut myself. My home is literally filled with computers. Mm-hmm. So I do not hate technology. And again, I embrace it.
Right.
I still love pencil and paper hand-drawn animation.
Have you ever like actively dabbled in 3D?
No, because I'm not good as a 3D animator. It takes a different part of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few people who can do both. My friend Bert Klein at Disney is able to animate traditionally, but he's also a very effective CG animator.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the few guys who can do both. Most animators can do one or the other,
mm-hmm.
and very few can do both and do it well. And I think, it uses different parts of your brain.
Yeah.
And you really totally think differently when you're drawing on paper or when you're having to move the rig. So it's a whole new thing. And yet CGI has become, I mean, think about it, how efficient it is.
Mm-hmm.
The digital production pipeline today is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we can make films as fast as we can today is, to me, a miracle. You know, it's incredible how fast we can get a film animated and into the theaters, where in the old days, doing it all, you know, when the whole process was done by hand,
mm-hmm.
it literally took forever. If changes had to be made, it took weeks to make animation changes. Animation changes today can be made in a number of days or a number of hours. So CG animation is incredibly efficient. Mm-hmm. And I don't take anything away from it because it works extremely well.
And now, like, freelance artists, in my personal experience, like, you have to fake how long it takes so they can still respect and pay you because it's so quick. You're like,
very true. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah, that's very true.
Because if you do it too quick, then they're like, why am I paying you this much?
Yeah, I know. That's really kind of funny. I tell people, I was talking to my producer friend just the other day about this little film he wants to make. And he says, I can get this thing animated in no time. He says, the thing that concerns me the most is the script and the storyboards. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's why I called you. And I said, oh yeah, you've called me to do the hard work. Right. You called me to write the story, to do the storyboard. And then after that, it's like, you know, it's a breeze because now right. You throw it into the production pipeline and whammo, it's done.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting how our business has changed. And again, I'm an old timer. I've been around forever. I feel like an animation dinosaur. I'm 87 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I came into this business when everything was done by hand. Mm-hmm. And yet today, I find the business, it remains fascinating. I mean, I love animation today as much as I ever did. It hasn't gotten old to me. It hasn't gotten mundane. I'm continually fascinated by this incredible medium. And I've been so lucky to have spent my life making animated films, and thankfully it's not over yet.
Yeah,
as people still ask me to do stuff for them,
right?
You know, I'm even though I'm rather, you know, I'm up in years, I'm still part of the process and still happy mm-hmm. to be a part of the part of making animated films.
Yeah, I did want to mention, I think rumbling in my head, I feel like a couple people that I'm thinking of that can do multiple versions of animation. I interviewed Lenny Graves. I think he can do 2D and 3D.
Yeah, Lenny. That's right.
There's a guy, Lyndon Barwar. He's originally from New Orleans. He does stop motion with gum wrappers, and I think he's also
with gum wrappers?
Yeah.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much about this business that is, it's really, you know, it's incredible. It's awe-inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Let me zoom through the rest of this list. And if any of it you want to talk
about. That list is way too long.
And anything you want to talk about, we can talk about after I'm done. So I'm going to zoom through it. Josie and the Pussycats, Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, Robin Hood, Jabberjaw, I'm the Greatest, The Adventures of Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali. I worked with Muhammad Ali. How about that?
Okay, we can pause for that.
True story. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I look back on my career and I look at some of the amazing people that I work with, and you know, you have no idea when you come into this business how your life is going to be impacted by, you know, literally incredible people, famous people, exceptional people that you have the opportunity to work with. And you never really, you know, gave it that much thought until you kind of look back on your career and look at the amazing people that you've been able to spend time with. And so, you know, and of course, Ali was just one of many, you know, one of many people that I've had the pleasure of working with.
You worked with Muhammad Ali, like when he was still vibrant?
Yeah, oh yeah, he was still... No, he was in good shape. I know. I bumped into him one day. I mean, literally bumped into him at a recording session. And yeah, he was solid as a rock. And, yeah, I wouldn't want him to hit me.
The new Fred and Barney shows,
The Flintstones. We brought back the Flintstones. Were a big hit in the 60s, I think, and in the 1970s. Hanna-Barbera wanted to bring back the Flintstones. And so we were part of the team that had to, you know, develop
Yeah.
The Flintstones for TV for a second time. Now, here's the thing that was so wacky about animation. You know, the first show, The Flintstones, was a big success. Mm-hmm. And so when several years later, Hanna-Barbera decided to bring it back, it was probably not Hanna-Barbera, probably the networks wanted to bring it back. And then we suddenly realized that all of that early stuff that had been done for the first series of Flintstone cartoons had all been thrown away. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing? All of that artwork, all of those backgrounds and layouts and character designs had literally been thrown away because in animation, nobody saved anything back in those days.
Right.
So we had to go back and reinvent the wheel, and that is recreate the Flintstones all over again, mm-hmm. because all the original stuff had been thrown into the dumpster. So that meant we had to make, you know, model sheets of all the characters. We had to design backgrounds and layouts and vehicles and all of this stuff, a lot of it from scratch. Mm-hmm. Because all of that original stuff that had appeared on TV, I believe in the 1960s, all that original Flintstone stuff had been thrown away.
Yeah.
But again, it gave us the opportunity to, when we did design this new show that we called the Fred and Barney Show, for some reason we couldn't call it the Flintstones. I don't know why. So we called it the Fred and Barney Show.
Yeah.
But it was fun to do because, again, the Flintstones were a huge hit in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so to bring the show back in the 1970s, a decade later, and it still had an audience. People still love the Flintstones, and they love Betty and Wilma and all of the wacky characters in this Hanna-Barbera show. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun doing that.
Yes, yeah, so I interviewed Carlton Zapp, who ended up working with Hanna-Barbera very closely.
Uh-huh.
You've worked on various Scooby-Doo properties.
Oh, Scooby-Doo. Yeah, Scooby-Doo forever. Good luck. Yeah, I mean, we would have gotten away with it, too, if it hadn't been for those meddling kids. They did a lot of Scooby-Doos, which I always say, you do a Scooby-Doo show, you're basically doing the same show again and again and again. The same show.
It's kind of similar to when I started, I tried watching Lifetime and Hallmark Christmas movies.
Yeah.
After, like, the fourth one, I'm like, I'm out. This is like with different characters.
Oh, yeah.
Super Friends.
Super Friends. I'm not really good at drawing. I wasn't really good at drawing the human figure, you know. You really have to know your anatomy and all of that. And I didn't really want to do that stuff. I enjoyed cartoon characters. Mm-hmm. And so drawing superheroes, I got stuck on a superhero show, Super Friends. And I felt, oh, man, I can't draw these characters. And so it was kind of a challenge and a chore to be able to draw all of these superhero characters. But, you know, we got through it. And yeah. I got it done. I'm not good at drawing superheroes anyway, but it was one of those, it was another challenge.
Yeah.
And we got through it.
Richie Rich,
the little rich kid.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
That was fun. The Secret of Nim.
No, did not work on that. That's my old buddy, Don Bluth.
Yeah.
Don Bluth did The Secret of Nim. Now, I did visit his studio a lot in those days because I wanted to see what Don mm-hmm. and his artists and animators were doing, because a lot of those guys were friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Don wanted to create something special with animation that would resemble the, the golden days of animation, when you really put a lot of time and care into crafting an animated project. Mm-hmm. And Don Bluth and his partner, Gary Goldman, and the whole team, these guys were committed to making an animated film to rival the early days of Disney. And so that's why I spent a lot of time at the Don Bluth studio, because I was really, really fascinated by what they were doing and how they were trying to basically bring back the golden days of animation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Smurfs.
loads and loads of Smurfs. Ended up, I worked on the initial pilot for the Smurfs at Hanna-Barbera, working with the creator of the Smurfs, a gentleman from Europe, whose name was Peyo. I think he was from Belgium. He only spoke French, did not speak English. I spoke English, could not speak French. So here we were having to work together. I couldn't speak his language. He couldn't speak our language. And yet somehow we managed to communicate, and we made this, I believe it was a half hour pilot called the Smurfs. And out of that half hour pilot came the TV series. They went on and on. And I swear, I think the Smurfs must have been in production for at least a decade at Hanna-Barbera. We did so many seasons. I remember I was doing storyboards for the Smurfs. And I remember I had my studio. I literally had a stack of storyboards on the floor because I didn't have any more shelf space for all the storyboards I had done. And eventually I threw all of those storyboards away. People have said, "What? You had Smurf storyboards and you threw them in the trash?" And I said, "Yeah, we didn't save stuff in the old days because it was just a lot of stuff."
Right.
And when you have a lot of stuff, then you have no place to put all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it just piles up around you. And so you have to get rid of it to make room for more stuff. So you throw it in the trash. And that's what I did. I kind of regret it now because I probably could have sold that stuff, but that's the way it was in the old days.
Montecito.
Tell it to the rich people in Montecito. That's right.
Yeah, I feel like that. So when my first job in animation was actually in South Korea, and I didn't know Korean, and my specific department barely knew English, so it was like art. We made it work.
Annyeonghaseyo. I was in Korea, believe it or not. I was in Korea, but I wasn't doing animation. They sent me there to shoot people. So there you go, which is not very nice.
All right.
No, I was in the military, and so I was. I was in Korea for about 14 months, carrying a rifle and getting shot at. But eventually, I made it back home where I could do animation where there's nobody trying to kill you.
Yeah, most of my friends were either teaching English, like my first year, I was teaching English, or they were in military.
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Were you located in Seoul?
My second year when I was working for the animation company, but the first year I was in Gwangju, Jeollanam-do, which is in the south.
Oh yeah, in the what was it? I'm trying to think of it about South Korea. What was? I forgot all the names now.
Busan.
I was in South Korea, and I felt safe there because we were far away from the from the DMZ, which was North Korea, near North Korea.
Yeah.
And I felt very uncomfortable up near Panmunjom.
Yeah.
Because that was the border of the North and South Korea and kind of like a dangerous spot. So I really wasn't happy being there. But
I never visited the DMZ. I was like, no thanks.
yeah, it's not a happy place. Although tourists go there. I mean,
it's a tourist attraction, but I was
blown away that pump. Panmunjom is a tourist attraction. I don't think so. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't find it a lot of fun.
Yeah. Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Alvin and the Chipmunks. Oh, yeah. Cute little characters. Ross Bagdasarian.
Heathcliff and Cadillac Cats.
Oh, man. Did I work on that? I think I did. Because I think I recall one of our directors was a wonderful Japanese fellow. And once again, he couldn't speak English. I could not speak Japanese, at least not much. Yet we somehow managed to work together and went over storyboards together. And, animation's international. You know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, you could do animation. And all of us always find a way to communicate with each other.
Punky Brewster?
You know what? I think I did work on that. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of stuff that, you know, you don't even, you barely remember. And you say, did I work on that? And they say, yeah, I guess I did. You know, barely remember it, but yeah.
The Black Cauldron?
No, did not work on it.
Okay.
An ill-fated Walt Disney feature film. I mean, good heavens. That's the movie. That's the Walt Disney feature film that never worked. I don't know why they decided to make that film in the first place. It was never a good idea. And the film never worked. Mm-hmm. And they worked really hard and they spent a lot of money. But I often think about The Black Cauldron as, well, you know what? It was a good training film.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the young men and women who came to Disney worked on that awful movie. And they kind of received their animation training that would pay off later on when they worked on the good movies. such as, you know, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, you know, Aladdin, The Lion King. All of those great movies really came out of that training period on that bad movie called The Black Cauldron. So sometimes out of something, you know, not so good,
yeah,
there's a benefit. And I think the big benefit from Black Cauldron, it was the training ground for a lot of young men and women who would go on to create some truly great Disney movies.
Did you work on Rocko's Modern Life?
Yeah, I love that. I love that series. I didn't work on it, but I was a big fan. I used to watch the show because I just loved its quirky sensibility. So no, I never worked on it, but I did like it. I did enjoy it.
Cats Don't Dance?
No, I was aware of it. And I knew a lot of people who worked on the film, but no, I didn't work on it.
Toy Story?
I think I was at Disney mm-hmm. at the time they were making that film. So, you know, you can't be everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Story 2?
What was that again?
Toy Story 2?
Oh, that. Yeah. I saw this marvelous movie that Pixar had done called Toy Story.
Mm-hmm.
And I so regret that I didn't work on that film because at the time when I was first asked to work on it, I had just signed the contract with Walt Disney Studios and I was under contract to Disney and could not leave and go to Pixar to work on Toy Story. But luck was on my side because some years later, Pixar asked me again if I would come up north and work on the sequel, Toy mm-hmm. Story 2, which I did. So I did move up to the Bay Area to work on Toy Story 2. This had to be in the middle, I know, I guess the late 90s. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I moved up there in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up at Pixar for about 3 years. So it was a great experience, and I had a marvelous time working at Pixar up in the Bay Area. So yeah, it was pretty cool.
What about Monsters, Inc.?
That's funny because that was a film that I was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
I had completed my work on Toy Story 2, came back down to the Walt Disney Studio, which was my, you know, supposedly my real job. And I got a call from the producer, Darla Anderson, who was producing a film called Monsters Incorporated. And she asked me if I would be willing to come back to Pixar to work on Monsters, Inc. And keep in mind, I had already been away from home for a number of years. I'd already been away from my wife,
mm-hmm.
Adrian, for a couple of days. Okay. All right. Adrian has just corrected me that it didn't really count because I came home every weekend.
Okay.
So yeah, I went up to Pixar to work on Monsters Incorporated.
Yeah.
But I came home every weekend. So I guess that doesn't count being away from home.
Okay.
But I was away from home during the week because I would fly up to Pixar on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I would fly back to Burbank on Friday. Mm-hmm. So I was gone all week, even though I came home on the weekends. So,
right.
Yeah. But keep in mind, you know, that was very generous of Pixar to pay for my plane ticket back and forth from Burbank to Oakland every week, so I could fly back home and spend time with my wife.
Yeah.
So that our marriage wouldn't come to an end. A lot of other marriages did.
All right.
Unfortunately, but probably for other reasons. So.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
The High Fructose Adventures of Annoying Orange.
You know, I often tell people I've worked on some of the classiest, most expensive animated films ever. And mm-hmm. I worked on some of the cheapest, cheesiest shows you can ever imagine. The Annoying Orange was one of those cheesy shows. It was cheap, you know, quick and dirty, cheap. And but having said that, I loved every minute of it because working on that stupid show was just a lot of fun. And my good buddy, Ken Micheroni, and I work with Kenny up at Pixar on Toy Story 2 and Monsters Incorporated. Mm-hmm. So I work with Kenny, who was directing the Annoying Orange. And we just had a ball doing that stupid show. You know the show. It's talking fruit,
right?
Oranges and bananas and other other fruit items. You know, it's a stupid TV show. You know, talking fruit.
Yeah. But
as dumb as it was, crazy as it was, and as annoying as it was, probably to a lot of parents,
right?
We just had a ball working on this stupid show. And, you know, animation doesn't always have to be all glamour and fancy stuff. You can work on a really dumb, cheap show and still have a ball doing it. So, you know, I love working on The Annoying Orange, and I'm so glad you remembered that animation classic.
Classic. So, you co-founded Vignette Films with my birthday twin, Leo Sullivan.
Yeah. Well, it was Leo's idea to make. I mean, I to me, it was just a hobby.
Yeah.
I just invented this name, Vignette, because I thought it would be a cool name for an animation company. You know, like, hey, we run this company called Vignette. I just chose the name because it sounded cool.
Right.
Well, lo and behold, Leo and our partners went out and made the company legit. And that is, it literally became a California corporation. Mm-hmm. We were Vignette Films Incorporated. Mm-hmm. We were a legit production company. A bunch of young men with no business education.
Right.
None of us had ever run a studio before. None of us had any business skills, not really.
Mm-hmm.
And we were literally learning how to run a company as we went along. And so that's how Vignette happened. But I'm proud to say that Vignette, even though we were all young and naive, what we accomplished, as I look back on it, was quite incredible because we made dozens of educational films.
Mm-hmm.
We made training films for the United States military.
Mm-hmm.
We made films for the State Department. And we made films for other government agencies. We were a film production company, a legitimate production company, contracting with corporate clients, with the U.S. government, and we were filmmakers. Now, we were never really acknowledged as such by the mainstream industry because what we were doing was just bread and butter stuff. But we were making films. We were getting paid for our services. We were African-American, you know, for the most part, African-American filmmakers running a filmmaking company in Hollywood. And nobody really acknowledged us because, you know, we were small potatoes.
Yeah.
Who cares about a little company that's, you know, just making films that are of no importance? Because when you're doing educational films, you know, there's no glamour in doing that, and there's certainly no money. However, we did that for a number of years, and I'm very proud of the work we did at Vignette, because I think our work was good, and what we did with our limited resources, I look back on it as really quite incredible. And when I look back on my career, some of the most satisfying times was when I ran my own company, mm-hmm. along with my partner, Leo Sullivan, Dick Allen, and Norm Edlin. Mm-hmm. Four young African-American men who had the audacity mm-hmm. to open a film company in Hollywood. And this was in the 1960s. You know, I mean, what a time to try to launch a film company in America in the 1960s.
Yeah.
You know, in the midst of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. What we did took a lot of guts, and we were audacious to even dream of doing such a thing, and yet we did it.
Maybe
we opened the company and we stayed viable for a number of years mm-hmm. before eventually we just ran out of money and clients and could no longer continue. But what we did was pave the way mm-hmm. for a lot of people of color who would come after us and do greater things.
Maybe being naive was what helped do that.
Well, part of being young is that you don't think about the obstacles, because if you think about it too hard, you're going to give up on it. So we were so determined and focused to be successful, we didn't think about all of the challenges that faced us. And we just forged ahead and said, we are filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And we want to make films, and we're going to do that, even though there are so many things against us, so many obstacles, so many doors slammed in our faces over the years because we were filmmakers of color mm-hmm. at a time when that was an extremely rare thing in Hollywood. You know, people of color making films, producing, directing, writing. For that time period, we were indeed bold and daring and a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did you all get the opportunity to do the Soul Train logo?
That came about almost, again, like a lot of jobs, these things happen by chance. We had worked on a TV show for ABC called Turn On. And the director of that TV show was a young man named Mark Warren. Once again, a black director at a time when there were very, very few African-American directors working in Hollywood. Well, we had worked with Mark on Turn On, this ABC sketch comedy show. And now Mark Warren had been given this TV pilot to direct. And it was about kids dancing. And it was called Soul Train. I didn't really know it because the show was a big hit back in Chicago. So I wasn't in Chicago, so I didn't even know much about it. Mm-hmm. We got a call from Mark Warren saying, hey, I'm directing this TV pilot called Soul Train, and I need a logo to put, you know, at the start of the show that introduces the show, and I want to use animation. Can you guys animate a train? You know, and so the train goes down the tracks, and then the logo Soul Train, you know, comes out of the smokestacks, I guess. And so, yeah, so that's how we ended up doing the Soul Train animated introduction. And again, you know, the rest is history. But again, it was just a job, just one of the many, many jobs that came our way. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we did any and everything. Mm-hmm. We did jobs for any client who would call us. We did a lot of logos for TV shows, you know. A lot of the big hit shows you watched on TV, a lot of the titles and end credits, we did. Nobody knew that because, you know, nobody knew who did those credits. But, you know, we did stuff for Laugh-In and a lot of high-profile network TV shows that we provided the main titles or the end credits. And that was the kind of thing we did, you know, just to be able to pay the rent.
Yeah.
Keep our doors open.
So I know you say you can't dance, but if you had to dance for your life down the Soul Train line, what dance would you do?
Oh, man, that would be horrendous. Yeah, you're right about that. I can't dance. There's no doubt about that.
You have to dance for your life.
I think what I would do, I think I would just walk down the line. You know, if I could just make it to the end just by walking, you know, I think I can groove to that. You know? But that's the best that I can do, because this black man has no rhythm.
You and Leo also collaborated on a project about this Tuskegee Airmen, where you drew a graphic novel. What did you enjoy about that project, and why was it important?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. The Tuskegee Airmen were these black pilots who actually flew during the Second World War, and their story really should be told, and it's one of the stories Leo wanted to tell, and he had met with a number of the pilots who had flown, who were trained at Tuskegee and who did fly during the Second World War. And so Leo asked me to do a graphic novel based on the Tuskegee Airmen, and which I did for him. And of course, George Lucas actually made a feature film. I believe it was entitled The Tuskegee Airmen. Red Tails. That's right. The Red Tails. Yeah, you got it. I couldn't even think of the title. So George Lucas did Red Tails, which was based on the Tuskegee Airmen. Mm-hmm. So, but there's still a lot of people who really don't know that much about this very important part of Black history. And so once again, I mean, we were guys who were making films on Black history. And so this was right up our alley. This was what we did best. And we did many, many projects where we were, and again, not only were we teaching others, but for ourselves, it became an educational experience for me, because I learned so much by making these films. I learned so much about my own history just by being involved in the writing and production of these films on Black history.
Yeah. You know, sometimes we don't ask our, you know, parents or grandparents like pointed questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any of your children, like grandchildren watching this, ask him questions.
Yeah, I know. And that's a very important, and you're right, we don't ask enough questions. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important part, because we have to know our history.
Yeah.
That's critical. We cannot be ignorant of our own history.
Yeah. My paternal grandfather was honored when Barack Obama was president, because he was, I didn't know. I don't know if anybody in my family knew, but he was one of the Montfort Point Marines, the Black Marines. Yeah. And so he got to go to the White House.
Wow.
When President Obama was president. And we're like, Did anybody know
this? And you didn't know, and you didn't know that. See? Right. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, yeah. There's so much we don't know, so much that, mm-hmm. you know, that we need to know. And so, and I think that's why that period of doing educational films mm-hmm. Was important for us, because, you know, entertainment is great, you know, and there's nothing wrong with entertainment, but the opportunity to educate, mm-hmm. that's pretty darn important as well.
Yeah.
More important, of course, more important than just entertainment.
Your natural personality of doing gags and being funny around the studio is what got you your job as a story man. Considering this, what would you say is the importance of bringing your full self to work and showing off your personality to the people you're working around?
Well, that happens anyway, doesn't it? I mean, that's gonna happen regardless, right?
Everybody brings their full self to work.
I always thought I brought my full self to work.
Yeah, that's why you need to give tips to everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know. No, and that's one of the things I loved about the studio experience, because I loved being around other creative people. And because there's this marvelous give and take. We all learn from each other. We all benefit from each other's skills. Mm-hmm. It makes all of us that much better. So, yeah, I think that's the great part about the collaborative nature of motion pictures. And I think that's a big part of why I like movies. And I kind of split it in half. There's two aspects of making a movie. There's that solitary part where you're working pretty much by yourself. You know, if you're a writer, you're in your office, you're in your room writing a script pretty much by yourself. But then again, when that script moves into production and other people get involved and more people come on board, and now that process becomes not solitary, but collaborative. And I love that aspect of creativity where there's collaboration, because now everybody brings their own personal gift to the table, their own personal skill, their own personal expertise, and it becomes a part of the whole. And that's what I love about motion picture production. That's what I love about animation production. I love the fact that it is a mix of talents, of men and women working together to create something special, to create something magical, and to share this with others. And so when the film comes to a close and the family kind of breaks up, and it is a family, and when we all go our separate ways, we miss that, because during that time of production, we spend time together and we become a family, you know, not related by blood, but related by the production. Mm-hmm. And so all of the people, all of the talented people who come together to put something magical on the screen, I think it's one of the wonderful aspects of film production. One of the things that I so love about this medium is the fact that it is not a solitary job. It's a job that you share with others, and your work is that much better. Mm-hmm. Because it benefits from the input of other men and women who add their two cents, and they make the final product that much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fun fact about me is that I collect quotes, and then I also like look into the history of the certain idioms. And yeah. So it's funny because there's the phrase "blood is thicker than water," which actually is the opposite of what the original one is, which is actually. Yeah. The blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb. So it actually yeah. means that your friends are thicker, is like more important than your family sometimes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The opposite of the shortened version.
Yeah. Sometimes you have more in common with the strangers than you do with your own family.
Yeah.
Ironically, that it works out that way sometimes. You know, it's like, for instance, that my family has never really totally shared my passion. Mm-hmm. For filmmaking or animation, with the exception of my youngest son, mm-hmm. nobody really cares or thinks that much about movies.
Yeah.
It's something they go see, but other than that, they have no real investment in a motion picture. They don't care how it's written. They don't care how it's produced. They don't care about the various aspects of yeah. motion picture production. It's just a mindset. I know that my youngest son does have a little bit of that, because he has an interest in cameras and computers and filmmaking, and he's been on movie sets and he's worked in TV shows and motion pictures, because he shares, but he's the only one of my kids mm-hmm. who seems to share that
yeah.
quirky passion of loving this goofy business of media. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. So one reason I started my platform is to introduce kids and parents to the various jobs that a person can have in the animation industry. The title of animator definitely has the best marketing and PR, and that's what you wanted to do when you started out.
Yeah.
Walt saw something different in you. What can you say about people about using your gifts for the right positions and not necessarily relying on the limited vocabulary or knowledge for what they think they should do? So like, you only had animator in your head, but then Walt saw Storyman in you. So like, what can you say about maybe not going for the PR of the animator and maybe discovering other things you can do?
Well, you don't want to get hamstring by the titles, and and be flexible and be open to change. Yeah, I came into this business because the term animator was the only term I knew. Mm-hmm. You knew that guys who made animated cartoons were called animators.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got to know more about this business and did more of a deep dive into animation production, you then learn there are, you know, screenwriters. You learn there are storyboard artists who visualize the script. you learn there's this whole area of art direction and production design and the background artists, as well as the animators who bring the characters to life. And then you learn about the technical aspects of post-production. Well, what I did, I learned that, you know what? I should not narrowly focus on one category, but to be open to doing everything. Mm-hmm. And I do mean everything from the script writing to editorial to, you know, being involved in the final mix of the final tracks, mm-hmm. To the color correction of the finished picture, the negatives, the to correct the color, that the colors are what's needed, and learn everything. And so whenever I'm teaching a class about animation, I said, don't limit yourself. Don't restrict yourself to one category, because you might start out doing one thing and end up being proficient, you know, in another.
Yeah.
You just don't know. And one of the things I love about this business is that I've pretty much done every job in this business, from being a voice actor, being a script writer, editing film, mixing tracks, shooting film, lighting. I went back to college to learn how to light, because I wanted to know what the cinematographer did. I wanted to know what the director of photography did on a movie set. Why did they place the lights in a particular position? Why did they do that? You know, what was the reasoning behind it? I learned what the director does in live action as well as in animation. You know, I learned about scene blocking. All of these things are going to make you that much better at whatever job you choose to do. Maybe one job, it may be multiple jobs. Mm-hmm. But the more you know about what you do, the better off you're going to be. And that is, the more you know, all of this knowledge informs everything you do. So I tell my students, don't just learn one thing. Learn everything. Mm-hmm. Learn it all. Know it all, because you may not necessarily use it, but chances are one day you will use it. Again, my learning how to read music when I was a kid, that wasn't because I was going to be a professional musician. It's because I just loved music. But one day that paid off when I was a filmmaker and the composer could put the score down in front of me and I could read the score. Mm-hmm. Because I had learned how to read music when I was a child.
Yeah.
So even though I never became a professional musician, learning to read music still paid off, mm-hmm. because it made me that much more knowledgeable about the job I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One reason I love Walt Disney and Disney Animation is because of the innovation. I've heard that, like, you know, Walt would introduce ideas that he wanted to create and it would seem impossible sometimes, but it pushed people out of their comfort zone and therefore pushed the industry forward. An additional thing I loved was that he not only had high expectations, but he provided the resources to get you there, like classes and animal studies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, what key elements made Walt Disney an innovator and pioneer? And what key elements made Disney Animation successful?
Walt Disney was one of those rare individuals that was, you know, just unique. He was self-taught. Mm-hmm. Never went to film school, never took a writing class, never had the opportunity of a university education. He just knew this stuff, or he learned on his own. And so when Walt saw the necessity for innovation, he made it possible for his staff to move forward. He provided the resources that were necessary to enable him to just do things better. He was able to come up with an efficient production pipeline. He was able to come up with camera systems that were ahead of their time. Looking back on relics like the multiplane camera, was a marvel of technology for its time. Over the years, the multiplane camera is now, you know, it's an ancient relic, but at the time it was a technological marvel. But Walt was always a forward thinker, always innovating, always pushing the technology and learning how to do things better. and not just better, but the best. I was talking to someone recently about the film we did back in the 1960s, Mary Poppins, which had a lot of compositing of live action and animation. We didn't have the technical tools we have today with digital technology. We had to do all of that compositing optically. And it was very tedious and painstaking. It was meticulous work. And yet you look at Mary Poppins today, a film made so many years ago, our optical compositing, our use of the sodium matte process, all of those today ancient technologies still hold up incredibly well, even today in 2022, mm-hmm. because the work we did was done so painstakingly, you know, carefully to get everything just right. And all of that was driven by Walt Disney to not do it just good enough, but to do the very best. And so that's the kind of man Walt was. He was a natural leader and a leader who didn't settle for good enough. He only settled for the very best. And when you have a person who pushes for excellence, I cannot disagree with a boss like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with wanting things to be done just right, to be perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. It may make you sound like a jerk sometimes. I know that Steve Jobs, when he ran Apple, was very much like Walt Disney. It was that Steve always wanted the best.
Yeah.
Good enough was never good enough. It had to be perfect. And if it wasn't perfect, you go back and work on it until it is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so Steve Jobs, much like Walt Disney, was a demanding perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to do something, we're going to do it right. You know, there's no halfway. We're going to do it right. And if we can't do it, we're going to go back and do it until we do get it right. So I've got no complaint with having a boss who's a perfectionist, because, you know, I work for two of them. I work for Walt Disney and I work for Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So both men who were crazy. But crazy in the very best way.
Yeah. So I've reached out to people to come on my channel. Some people don't respond. Some people say no. Some people are actually surprised I've reached out to them because their particular part of the industry is not usually highlighted. So through all your speaking engagements that you've done, what have you realized is the importance of sharing your experience? And what makes you feel it's an obligation to share the knowledge you have?
Well, sharing is very important. Keep in mind that when I came into this business as a young kid, I had the opportunity of learning from the animation masters. And I mean the women and men who made the classic animated films when I was a child. So they already had decades of experience when I was able to meet them. And thankfully, these men and women were gracious in sharing that knowledge with all of his kids. They didn't have to do this. They could have kept it all for themselves. But for the most part, they were extremely generous and patient to sit down with us kids, many of us right out of art school.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us didn't even go to art school. But they would sit down with us and patiently teach us the craft. And so as we learn from them, I think we have an obligation to pass it on, to take what we've learned from the masters, from the veterans, and then pass that on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't, all of that knowledge is going to be lost. Now, a lot of it has been saved. It's been put down in books and lectures and again, a lot of material that's available online. Again, a lot of information that's available. So it's there.
Yeah.
It's accessible.
Yeah.
But I think we as animation professionals have an obligation and a responsibility to take what we've learned and pass it on to the next generation. So, you know, and I'm happy to do so. One of the things I enjoy a good deal is being able to work with young students, with young filmmakers. mm-hmm. with young animators and young writers and young designers. They help them craft their film, mm-hmm. to help them tell their story, and to be whatever help I can be to them, as the old veterans helped me when I was a young kid just learning my way. Hopefully I can provide some expertise. They help the new artists and the new creators as they find their way.
Can you talk about the movie Bushhead, who you were working with and what you felt the film could have provided to the animation industry at the time?
Wow. There's an interesting segue. Bushhead was a project that sadly was never completed. Mm-hmm. It caught me by surprise. I remember at the time, it was the 1970s, and I was animating at Hanna-Barbera. I remember that time in particular. Smokey Robinson, who was part of Motown, mm-hmm. Partnered with Berry Gordy, who was the founder of Motown. Motown had moved to Hollywood, and they had a series of offices on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And I was invited down to Motown to meet with Smokey Robinson and his team. And it concerned a animated motion picture that Smokey wanted to do. Smokey was going to write all of the music for a new animated film called Bushhead. And it was going to be about a prehistoric caveman, except that this caveman was a caveman of color. Mm-hmm. He wasn't Fred Flintstone. He was going to be a black caveman. Mm-hmm. And because he had this big fro, his nickname was Bushhead. And that was the title of our movie. Mm-hmm. And so we had heard that Smokey wanted to do this film. And we spent about 6 months in developing character designs, environments, art direction, model sheets, storyboards. And we presented all of this material in a big meeting with Berry Gordy, mm-hmm. who, like I said, was the head of Motown. And Berry Gordy had this deal that he was going to interest Universal Pictures into coming up with the money to produce this animated feature film called Bushhead. Well, it turns out at the time, Universal Pictures was involved with another project of Berry Gordy's called The Wiz. Mm-hmm. And Universal said, you know, we don't have the money to do both. Mm. You can either do The Wiz or you can do Bushhead, but you can't do both. So I think we all know which project got the green light.
Yeah.
And of course, we never heard from Bushhead ever again.
Yeah.
But that's what happened.
What would you say your favorite aspects of African-American culture and the positivity we exhibit as a community?
I think immediately the first thing that comes to mind is music. Music. Mm-hmm. I think our music is not from church spirituals to the clubs, the jazz clubs, you know. I hear black music and it's, you know, I mean, even going to a church service and hearing the performance of the choir and some of the singers, you know, there's nothing quite like that. Mm-hmm. I had a visitor who came all the way from Europe. Mm-hmm. He came all the way from Italy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he wanted to do in America was to go to a black church, because he wanted to experience that kind of special magic that happens in a black church when the choir performs. There's nothing like it. I remember it when I was a child going to church, my home church in Santa Barbara, where my mother and my grandmother attended. And of course, my mother sang in the church choir. Mm-hmm. My mother sang loudly. I mean, I never forget. I could hear her voice over all the others. You know, I don't know if my mother was great, but if she wasn't great, she was sure loud. But anyway, no, there's that special quality. When I was doing educational films, one of the films that I had the opportunity to direct back in the 1960s, and we did a number of, you know, these were short films. They ran no more than 12 minutes or 14 minutes in length. So they were very short films. Mm-hmm. But one of the subjects I was lucky enough to direct this film was on the composer W.C. Handy. And W.C. Handy composed a lot of blues, St. Louis blues being one of the, probably the most notable. But having the opportunity to, once again, to make a movie and to work with musicians, and especially Black musicians. And you know, it's just been a joy. One of the guys I wanted to bring on board to work with us on this film was the musical director, H.B. Barnum, who's a well-known musical director in the industry. And H.B. Barnum at the time was recording an album at Capitol Records in Hollywood with the vocalist Lou Rawls. And H.B. said, you know, Lou doesn't like to record in the daytime. He only likes to record at night. So he says, well, why don't you come to Capitol Records so we can talk about your movie? And if you don't mind coming at night, because Mr. Rawls doesn't like to record in the daytime. So it was, again, just one of those fun things I was able to do. I drove up to Capitol Records in Hollywood, mm-hmm. to the recording studio. And I don't mean behind a glass booth. I mean, I was there in the studio, literally in the studio with Lou Rawls as he recorded his album that evening at Capitol Records. And I was there the whole time, that whole night with H.B. Barnum and at the piano, the baby grand piano. And Lou Rawls recording his album, and I was there with him, literally in the studio. Mm-hmm. So, you know, stuff like that. You know, that's some of the perks of being in this business.
Yeah.
And one of the things I so love about filmmaking, and about all of the components of filmmaking, mm-hmm. not the least of which is music. The music is very important. And as a frustrated musician myself, I wish I had the musical talent and ability to just, you know, to just play great music. At best, I'm a mediocre musician. I played tenor saxophone, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. I was not great, certainly not a genius by any means. But I tell you, when you play in a band, and again, when I was playing in the band, I was playing in a big band.
Yeah.
A big band is really special because you are literally engulfed in the music and you are part of that sound. To me, when I played in the big band and to be surrounded by all of those talented musicians, both men and women, mm-hmm. who were in this big band, the experience is so special. It's, yeah. What's that word? Transcendental. I just felt like I was on top of the world. I felt it was a high, like no other high, just playing music and being a part of that sound. And of course, as musicians of color, mm-hmm. as Black musicians, nobody does it better. So
I've heard people talk about like the Black church and like shedding sessions where they just kind of improvise and even. Yeah. And white musicians will talk about how it's like, it's not, you can't even learn that in school.
You can't. Yeah, you can't. You feel it.
Yeah.
You live it. You breathe it. And I think a lot of that, you know, that tradition of jazz comes right out of the Black church, you know, because you think, where have I felt this before? Where have I heard this before? And I always trace it back to a church service. You know, and so many of our popular singers, you know, really gifted vocalists, they really cut their teeth on performance. They learned singing in church. You know, they sang in the church choir, they sung at revivals. Mm-hmm. All of that fantastic musical ability came out of their first performance, which was usually in the Black church. And I'll tell you, when you get a church choir going full tilt, there's nothing like it. I mean, talk about raising the roof.
Yeah.
Literally, you feel like you're the top of the church is going to blow off.
Yeah.
There is so much energy, so much joy, so much passion. It is incredible. Yeah, it really and truly is. So I think that aspect of filmmaking, music is such an important part of making a motion picture. And that's why I've always made it a point, whenever I worked on a movie, and I still do it to this day, one of the people I always have to meet when I work on a movie, I need to meet the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always met all the composers of almost, I think, pretty much every movie I worked on, I've gotten to meet the composer. One of the new guys that I'm proud to call a friend is a new younger composer. His name is Michael Giacchino.
Mm-hmm.
He's written a lot of scores for Pixar and Disney, as well as other motion pictures. And Michael is just such a talented guy, and I just love his work. But once again, I feel honored. I feel blessed to be around these amazing people.
Yeah.
And to be part of the work we all do together.
I can't not mention, so I met you for the first time at Norman Essence Fest in 2016 when you did
your
documentary, Floyd Norman, An Animated Life. And luckily for me, I was the only person standing in line that recognized you. So I was able to have an uninterrupted conversation with you for like 20 minutes. But also, because I was a sucky millennial, I took a blurry selfie with you. So when I went to your gallery opening several weeks ago, that's why it was important for me to take another picture with you, because I had to redeem it. I was like, I need to take a clear picture with Floyd Norman. And then, so at Essence Fest, after they showed your film, we got to go online and get a drawing from you. So I still have the drawing you did.
Oh no, Scooby.
Because
of all drawings to make, it had to be Scooby-Doo.
It was important to me because I don't know if it was through the documentary or through you talking, I realized we both had a time with Scooby, because I had a time with Scooby when I worked in Korea. I had a experience where, you know, when I would get frustrated, I would walk around another level in the animation company, because it was like a square. So I would just go to another floor and walk around. But particular situation with a Scooby thing that I had to do, I walked around a Korean block, which is similar to I didn't realize at the time, but it's similar to a New York City block. So I was walking for a while, but I didn't need that time to calm down.
Oh yeah.
Why so not? I had you draw this to symbolize our dislike for Scooby.
Yeah, I've had a love hate relationship with Scooby. I really, he's kind of a pain in the butt, but he's a good dog and he means well. And boy, I worked on more Scooby shows than I can remember. Mm-hmm. But you know, he helped pay the bills. You know, he helped pay the bills when I was a struggling young animation artist. So maybe I owe a lot to Scooby. And I knew his creators, by the way, too. I knew the two guys who created Scooby-Doo. And that was Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, who were producers at Hanna-Barbera. And they created this dog that went on to make Hanna-Barbera a fortune. And wouldn't you know it, as always, the creators of Scooby-Doo never got any money off of Scooby, because they did it while they were employed at Hanna-Barbera, which meant the company owned the character and not them. Mm-hmm. So all the money Scooby made for Hanna-Barbera, and now I think for Warner Brothers, didn't go to the creators. It went to the studio.
Yeah.
So I often say, all right, you young people, beware when you create a property and you don't own it.
Yeah.
It means you're going to make somebody else rich. It won't be you, but some studio is going to get rich off of your creation.
I think we're seeing a lot of that in the animation industry in the past several months, of like all the happenings that are going on, like the importance of ownership.
Yeah. And again, that's not an easy task, because a lot of studios will not give up ownership. You know, as a matter of fact, a lot of them, unless they can own your creation, they have no interest in doing it.
Yeah.
Because their idea is they're the ones who are going to get rich, not you.
Yeah.
So it's a tough one. And if you're going to own what you create, you've got to really hang tough, because they're going to try to talk you out of it. Because after all, ownership, that's where the money is.
Yeah.
If you don't own what you create, then somebody else is going to get rich off of what you create.
Yeah.
That's just the plain and simple truth. That's business. That's show business. That's why they call it a business, because it is a business. And yeah, they aren't there to make you rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for darn sure.
You mentioned your children. You have twin daughters. And
yes, I do.
I have a twin brother.
How about that?
Yeah.
No, twins are good. I mean, why not? You know, two's better than one. It's like, you know, buy one, get one free. You know, that's what the hospital said. When I went to the hospital, I had my twins. They said, buy one, get one free. So I came home with two girls instead of one.
When we were born, I actually got to be on TV because me and my brother were one of three sets of twins that were born at the same hospital in the same night.
Boy, talk about, man, what a lucky night.
So we got to
talk about hitting the jackpot.
So I have video of my newness.
That's great. That's great. No, that's nothing wrong with being a twin. I like twins.
So can you talk a little bit about being a father, and like, what do you like about being a dad?
I've always wanted to be one. Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed when people say that they don't want to have children, mm-hmm. or they don't want the responsibility of children. I could see why people would maybe not want to go through that. It ain't easy being a parent. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. I knew that going in. And I know that with all of the challenges and sometimes difficulty of being a parent, I wouldn't have it any other way. And I don't regret being a father. Mm-hmm. I don't regret being a parent. I think if you're not a parent, there's going to be so much you're not going to learn about life. It literally, being a parent, it's going to change who you are. It impacts your life in such a profound way that you are never the same person. And yet I can sympathize with those who don't want this responsibility of being a parent to a bunch of kids, because there will be challenges, because it's not easy. It's not easy dealing with little ones. It's not easy dealing with big ones. But it's going to be a challenge all the way through. Mm-hmm. But out of all that, I find it's been, for me anyway, incredibly rewarding. I love my kids. I like my kids. They've given me tough times, all of them, my sons, my daughters. They haven't always been easy. Some have been tougher than others. Mm-hmm. Some have been, you know, very mild and mellow and not a problem. Others have been just raising the dickens. But, you know, they're all different. They're different personalities. So each one has their own particular challenge. But quite frankly, I have no regret being a parent. I have no regret being a father. It is probably one of the more important things I've done in my life. Mm-hmm. And when I look at my life and my career, I have to say being a parent is probably the most significant thing I've done with my life. It's important. It's important. And I have no regrets. I think being a parent has not only been, you know, it's been really good for me. I think I have, you know, of all of us, I think I'm the one who's probably benefited the most. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the recipient of the blessings. So yeah, I've got no complaints.
So my last question is, what do you hope for the future of animation as far as innovation, storylines, and characters?
Yeah, I have no hopes except that I know that our business will continue to change and innovate as it always has. People often ask me, you know, what was it like when technology impacted animation? And I said, technology has impacted animation from the beginning, from the 1920s through the 1930s, the 40s, the 50s. Animation has been continually evolving over the years, and it will continue to evolve in the years to come. What that evolution is going to be, I don't know. Where it's going to go, I don't know. I remember once when I was, some years ago, I was speaking up at Apple, and somebody in the audience says, Floyd, what do you see as the future of animation? And I said, that's not for me to answer. That's for you. I said, you young people will determine the future of animation, not me. I've had my shot. Mm-hmm. I've been in this business for over 60, nearly 70 years. I've made my contribution. I've had my shot. The future, it's not up to me. The future is really up to you. You are the ones who are going to be taking animation to the next level, whatever that level happens to be. So, you know, it's you, not me. You determine where animation goes next. And but I think it's going to be, whatever that place is, it's going to be exciting.
Yeah. So I want to thank you for allowing me to highlight you as a full human being on the platform.
A full-fledged human being. Yeah, here I am.
Not just Floyd Norman, like the person who worked at Disney.
Yeah, I'm Floyd Norman, the person who worked at Disney, Hanna-Barbera, Ruby Spears, mm-hmm. Kurtz and Friends. Where else? I've worked everywhere. I worked all over town, but enjoyed every minute of it. And if you are lucky enough to be in this crazy business, and it is crazy, no doubt about it, it is a crazy business. But I tell you, I love it. And at age 87, and I mean, I'm 87 years old, and it's not old yet. I'm old, but animation is not old. Animation still has a long way to go. Mm-hmm. So if you're lucky enough to be on this train, keep riding the train, because you never know where it's going.
Soul train.
There you go. That's right. That's right. Keep on riding that soul train.
And to everyone out there, I want you to like so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Citadel and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.
Boom.